From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. In a moment, overcoming pessimism and later genetics and why we do what we do. But here's what's happening. Well, the situation in Iran still continues to get tense. In a speech published on his website, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said the ultimate goal of world forces must be to annihilate Israel. Speaking to ambassadors from Islamic countries ahead of Jerusalem Day, an annual Iranian anti-Zionist event established in 1979 by the Ayatollah Khomeini, Ahmadinejad said that a horrible Zionist current had been managing world affairs for about 400 years. Look, I'm going to predict if he continues with this kind of rhetoric, something's going to happen. It's going to happen sooner than later. Three planes at Reagan National Airport in Washington, D.C. came very close to crashing because of an air traffic control miscommunication. Now, the incident occurred Tuesday afternoon when air traffic controllers were making adjustments for landing and departing aircraft because of bad weather. Everybody's okay. U.S. astronauts won't land on Mars by themselves, but with international partners in the 2030s. According to NASA's chief, Curiosity rover's risky landing on the red planet, scheduled for 1:31 a.m. Eastern time in the morning, Monday morning, Sunday night into Monday morning, I'll be on the air. We'll have a complete program for you on this. We'll keep our fingers crossed. Robert Zubrin with us, of course, expert on Mars. Robert, so if we go with other people from international partners, that's a good thing, isn't it?
Well, I'd be fine with that, except this NASA administrator has done everything in his power to sabotage international collaboration. We had an agreement to collaborate with the Europeans on the 2016 Mars orbiter and the 2018 Mars rover, and they reneged on the agreement, leaving the Europeans high and dry. So we've been left with no Mars missions for 2016 and 2018, and the European program has been set adrift and is possibly could be sunk by this as well.
All right, 2030. I mean, we're talking about 18 years from now. Can't we speed up that goal?
Sure. We're better prepared technically today to send humans to Mars than we were to send men to the moon in 1961, and we were there 8 years later. If we were serious, we could have humans on Mars within a decade. The problem is this administration is not serious.
All right, Bob. Bob Zubrin. Researchers have discovered the cells and tumors that seem to be responsible for the regrowth of tumors. Three separate studies now on mice appear to have confirmed the view that the growth of tumors is driven by so-called cancer stem cells. The researchers claim to have resolved one of the biggest controversies in cancer research, and they say their work marks a paradigm shift in the field. Doctors often successfully reduce the size of tumors through various therapies, but often patients suffer a relapse. The tumor regrows. Now, some researchers believe that this happens because therapies fail to eradicate a small portion of cells that drive tumor growth known as cancer stem cells. They believe that these are the cells that should be targeted to eliminate the tumor forever. This could be a breakthrough in the treatment and the fight against cancer. The psychiatrist who was treating Colorado movie massacre suspect James Holmes warned a University of Colorado threat assessment team that he could be a danger, but no action was taken because he soon dropped out of school. Dr. Peter Bragan, psychiatrist with us. Boy, this is unfortunate to hear this one. Nobody acted. This almost sounds like 9/11, Peter.
Yeah, it's let me lay out the chronology.
Okay.
It was the first 10 days of June that Dr. Fenton got her own threat assessment team that she had helped to form at the university, contacted them, and alerted them that Holmes was a problem, and according to one source, that he purchased an assault rifle, which is a huge red flag. Then 10 days later, he drops out of the neuroscience program. And at this point, the beta team in the school decide they no longer have any responsibility for him, when in reality, you know, his dropping out, his not doing well, was even more alarming, given the assault rifle and goodness knows what else she knew. Then, of course, on July 20th, only 38 days later, he commits these early morning assaults. Now, The school is denying any responsibility, but Dr. Fenton was a paid employee, which would probably put the school at risk for negligence, any that she committed. The media is talking mostly about the duty to warn statutes in Colorado, which do say, quote, reasonable and timely efforts must be made to notify any person or persons specifically threatened. Also could notify the police instead, and she could hospitalize the patient. But the duty to warn is hardly the easiest, quickest way to handle the problem. A psychiatrist in Colorado, indeed, George, is rather scary. Almost any medical doctor and most health professionals and any policeman in Colorado can enforce a 72-hour involuntary hold, take the person themselves to a hospital, call the police or the sheriff, and take a person to a hospital. So if she had thought he was a danger, she has a responsibility regardless of whether he's just dropped out of school. In fact, that I didn't
That's a good increase. Point.
She has a responsibility then to take some kind of an action, and the simplest would have been the 72-hour hold.
It seems, Peter, then that everybody dropped the ball, doesn't it?
Everybody dropped the ball. But there's some other stuff about her now that has surfaced.
What's that?
She has been in trouble with the Colorado Board of Examiners in 2005 for improperly prescribing Xanax, Ativan, Ambien, and Vicodin to guess who? Herself and her husband and an employee. This is a very, very serious problem, and you wonder, hey, what's going on with this person? Is she an addict? Was she an addict? And finally, if she'd been giving him psychiatric drugs, during this period of time, most of which can cause violence, like antidepressant stimulants, benzos, she could be responsible for that. And remember, George, one last thing. I mean, it's kind of mind-blowing. Remember that the shooter claimed he had Vicodin, that he was taking large amounts of Vicodin before the shooting, one of the very drugs she'd been accused of misprescribing. We're getting a deep and complicated issue here.
Peter, I want to thank you, by the way, for staying with us on this story since its inception. I mean, you have done just a phenomenal job giving our listeners the information behind some of these stories here. And I just want to thank you.
Thank you, George, for the opportunity.
That's Dr. Peter Bregan. His website, Bregan.com, Bregin.com. It's part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Well, imagine this. Scientists drilling deep into the edge of Antarctica. And what do they pull up? Proof that palm trees once grew there. Wow. Analysis of pollen and spores and the remains of tiny creatures have given a climactic picture of the period about 53 million years ago. Boy, I wonder what was going on this planet then. Have you ever run into people who are pessimistic? Have you ever run into people who are optimistic? Big difference. In a moment, we're going to be talking rainy brain, sunny brain. Elaine Fox joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Elaine Fox, currently a visiting research professor in the Department of Experimental Psychology at the University of Oxford, leads a program of research combining cognitive psychology, neuroimaging genetics. Elaine's research is focused primarily on the nature of selective attention, and she has used this body of evidence to investigate the characteristics of people prone to anxiety, depression, and for the next couple hours with her, we're going to talk about the roots of optimism and pessimism and how we can retrain our own brains to be more optimistic. Elaine, welcome to the program. Hi.
Thanks very much, George. How are you?
My pleasure. Great job with your book, by the way, Rainy, Brainy, Sunny Brain. I like
Thanks
that.
Thanks very much.
You know, you say some things in the book that's absolutely true. There are some people that will look at a cup and say it's half full. There are other people who look at a cup and say it's half empty. That's the difference between an optimistic person and a pessimistic person, or it's cloudy, it's partly sunny, it's partly cloudy. What makes the two people so different, Elaine?
Well, you're absolutely right, and it's always been at the heart of my own research. I've been absolutely fascinated about where these differences come from. And at the very core of these differences, what the research is now showing us, George, is that we have very selective cognitive biases to process certain kinds of information. So if I just explain what I mean by cognitive bias, basically our brain prioritizes information that's important to us or information that's relevant in some way. Your listeners probably know the well-known cocktail party effect. Imagine you're in a busy room, there's lots of chatter, there's lots of noise going on. If somebody happens to mention your name on the other side of the room, your ears prick up and you notice it. So we have this uncanny ability to pick up things that are highly relevant to us or interesting to us. Now, these processes, so our brain is a little bit like a radar, if you like, constantly scanning the world around us. But these things go on at a very subliminal level. Generally, we're not aware about this. Our brain is just tuning in to what's going on in our surroundings. Now, we know that our brain fairly automatically is constantly tuning in to both threatening kind of information, things that might harm us in some way, or things that are good for us, so positive things. So these are the two fundamental biological motivators, if you like. So things that might harm us, things that are of some benefit to us. So each of us, everyone who's born, has these very fundamental biases to tune in to either the good stuff or the bad stuff. But of course, as we learn and we grow up, people actually develop differences in these kind of biases. And one of the really exciting things that the research has found recently is that these biases aren't just an outcome of, say, anxiety or depression, because it makes sense that if you're very depressed, you'll be very likely to notice more negative things, you'll be more likely to remember negative things, and we know that that's the case. But what the recent research has been finding is that actually those biases, it works in the other direction. Those biases can actually lead to changes in anxiety and depression, or, of course, optimism and being a bit more upbeat.
Are we generally optimistic or pessimistic, the brain?
Well, that's actually another really interesting question. I think particularly in current times with economic recession and all the rest of it, many people think that actually there's a huge wave of pessimism. But actually, when you do the surveys internationally, and there was a large survey done a couple of years ago in about 17 different countries, the vast majority of people actually report that they're pretty optimistic about the future, which may surprise a lot of people. So there's a kind of a paradox going on here. On the one hand, we know that the fear system in our brain, which I argue in Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain, is the root of our rainy brain. So the fear system is really the root of our pessimistic mindset. Now, the fear system will always trump the pleasure system. It will always, be much stronger pull for our brain. So there's kind of a paradox there. So we know that the fear brain, grabs our attention far more than positive things. But on the other hand, when we do these surveys, we find that most people are actually pretty optimistic. And again, I think there's good reasons for that. I think optimism, it is often called the optimism bias or the positivity illusion. If, for example, if you ask people, how likely do you think you are to earn more than the average through your life? The vast majority of people say, I think it's a pretty safe bet, I'm going to earn more. If you ask people, do you think you're a better driver than the average? Again, about 80% of people say, yes, I think I'm a better driver than most people. Now, of course, that's technically impossible. If you think about it, 80% of us can't be better than the average. So I think we have this very inbuilt tendency to look on the bright side, if you like. We also underestimate the chances of bad things happening to us. The same kind of research asks people, what are the chances you might get a serious illness? Again, people underestimate that. And I think there's good reasons for this, because it's kind of what gets us out of bed in the morning, in a sense. If we didn't have an optimistic take on a lot of things, we'd probably struggle just getting through our everyday life. So there is that kind of paradox. We know that the negative stuff has a stronger draw on us, and we notice it more. But on the other hand, most of us actually are pretty optimistic.
And there are some people, though, Elaine, who will do exactly as you've just said. They'll stay in bed all day. They're so down. They're so depressed. They're so pessimistic about things. They can't even get out of bed.
Absolutely. And this is one thing I really try and emphasize in the book. When I'm talking about optimism, I think we need to think of optimism in much broader terms. I think a lot of the time we think of optimism just in terms of positive thinking. Now, obviously, positive thinking is a part of it. But when we do the research, what we find is that there are actually about four or five different components to optimism, and positive thinking is only one of those. So one crucial component is actions. So in the book, I argue that actually positive actions are much more important in many ways than positive thinking. So we know that optimists tend to get out there and do things. When they're knocked back, when something doesn't work out, they'll try again. They'll look for another solution. And we know that this is one of the features that probably leads to, say, greater success in business, because we know people with a very optimistic type of take on things tend to be more successful on average. And this isn't so much to do with positive thinking. It's actually to do with the positive actions. And another important component of optimism is persistence. So the idea that actually people will just keep going. Now, there's lots of evidence for this. I give a nice anecdote in the book from Thomas Edison, the guy who invented the electric light bulb. He was trying to invent an electric lamp, and he was going through his lab book and realized that he tried out lots and lots of different ways to try and develop a lamp. And he famously said, "We haven't failed. We've just discovered 10,000 ways that don't work." So that kind of gives us an insight into, the mind of a real optimist. And we do this, we can demonstrate this in a very simple laboratory study. And I do this most years with my second year lab class, for example, undergraduates. And what we do is a very simple test. We give everybody a questionnaire. So we divide people into those who are more optimistic and those who are more pessimistic. And then we give them an anagram task. So just a jumble of letters, and people have to come up with a word from those letters. Okay. So we give them a couple of these to get them going. But we have one word in there that's actually impossible to solve. There's a jumble of letters, and there's actually no word you can make up from those letters. So a simple outcome measure is, how long does it take people before they give up, before they say, I can't actually find any word in here? Every year it works time and time again. The optimists tend to take twice as long before they give up compared to the pessimists. So again, that's a very simple laboratory demonstration that reflects what we see in real life, this idea of absolute persistence. Now, that, again, doesn't really have much to do with positive thinking, but is an absolutely core part of optimism. So that's one of the things I'm really trying to talk about in Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain is that we need to think more widely than just positive thinking. Another really important thing, just going back to your question, is having a sense of control. This is absolutely a core element of optimism.
Yeah, that's critical. I think that's critical, isn't it?
Absolutely critical, yeah. And when you talk about, some people really struggle to get out of bed in the morning, we know that people who are highly pessimistic, particularly those who are depressed, they absolutely have this sense that, things happen in the world outside. They're being buffered around from pillar to post, if you like. And the sense is that, there's not much you can do about it. People just have this feeling that I don't have any control. I'm a bit powerless. I can't do much about it. Optimists are very different. No matter how difficult the situation gets, they have a real sense that they do have some degree of control. No matter how small it might be, there's something they can do to get themselves out of the situation. So it kind of links in with the persistence and having a lot of energy and all the rest of it.
Sure.
But that sense of control is absolutely critical to well-being, and is an absolute core component of depression, the inability to kind of take control and the inability to get out and take actions.
Is optimism, Elaine, the same as confidence?
I don't think it is, actually. I think, and again, one of the things I try and argue in the book is that we absolutely need both sides. We need our rainy brain and our sunny brain. So we shouldn't try and suppress the pessimistic side, because it's there for a good reason. Pessimism and optimism both evolved because they bring benefits to us. So I think on balance, optimists do tend to have a lot more confidence in their ability to work things out in the longer term. One of the things that lots of people I've interviewed, people are very optimistic. One of the things they often say is that, it's not that they don't think that things are not going to work out. A lot of people kind of feel that actually they're quite realistic. So they think, well, maybe my business plan won't work out well. Maybe I won't get that job I'm really aiming for. But their overarching sense is that no matter what happens, no matter what goes wrong, they'll be able to cope with it. They'll be able to deal with it. So in a sense, they're confident, more confident in that longer-term sense, but they're not necessarily more confident about the shorter-term goals. I think, you know, a lot of pessimists will actually look very realistically at, well, what might go wrong. And of course, a lot of the time, that's very accurate. You know, things do go wrong, not everything will work out. But it's this overarching sense of having this, you know, ability to deal with whatever life throws at you, even when things you really want don't work out for the best.
All right, Elaine, we're going to take this short break, and we're going to come right back and talk more about your work and get into whether people who are pessimistic can simply become optimistic. Let's see what we can do. Elaine Fox, our guest for a couple hours. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're with psychologist Elaine Fox talking about her work on optimism and pessimism. Rainy brain, sunny brain. Elaine, are you related to actor Michael J. Fox at all?
No, I'm not at all, no, as far as I know.
But you've done some work with him, though, haven't you?
That's right, I have, yes. It actually was a couple of years ago now. Michael was making a documentary called The Adventures of an Incurable Optimist. It was an ABC documentary. And I had just published a paper at the time, which got a lot of media attention, and it was heralded as the discovery of the optimism gene. Now, as I explain in the book, it's not actually an optimism gene, but a lot of media, that was the title it was given to. So Michael's producer picked this up, and they invited me to come across to New York and get involved in the documentary and actually test him. So I gave my cognitive test to Michael as well as our genetic test. So we looked at what particular genes he had in terms of the genes that I'd been studying. So it was a fascinating couple of days. We did a lot of filming. We gave him our attentional bias test. I think I mentioned earlier we talked about cognitive biases. So as I said, one of the problems with these cognitive biases is they work at a very subliminal level. So it's very difficult to identify them and isolate them. But by using computerized tasks where we flash up images very, very rapidly, so we flash up, say, very positive images, very negative images, and people have to search for little hidden targets. So that kind of task gives us a very subtle window into where people's brains are tuning in automatically. So we gave this to Michael on camera, and sure enough, not surprisingly, he showed a very, very optimistic kind of pattern. So his brain automatically tuned in to very positive things and actively avoided the more negative images. So he had these two things going on. He was avoiding the negative and he was tuning into the positive, which fits what we find. Most people who are highly optimistic, they have that kind of cognitive style, if you like. And Michael himself, I suppose most people know he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease.
That's right. Very bad, too.
Exactly, very sad when he was about 28, 29, I think. He was very, very young. Now, when I interviewed him afterwards, when I was writing the book, he is one of these interesting things. It reflects what a lot of optimists say. He said he absolutely knew at the time that this would really have a huge impact on his acting career. He just knew that he would not be able to continue at the same level that he had. And he said, obviously, he got very down for a while. He went through a difficult period for a while, which is very, very understandable. But he said that the thing that kind of surprised him was that he never really felt that he wouldn't be able to deal with it. He said he's always kind of had this sense that, you know, no matter what life throws at him, he's going to be able to deal with it. So even though he looked up about Parkinson's, he learned a lot about Parkinson's, he could see that it was going to degenerate, you know, and that it wasn't a particularly rosy future. But he just had this strong sense that, you know, he would be able to cope with it. And he was fascinated by where that comes from, and of course that's exactly what my research is about. So it was a very, very interesting thing to do, and as I said, we did a lot of this as part of the documentary, and I interviewed him subsequently, and he absolutely is pretty much an incurable optimist, as he says himself.
He's a good guy. Elaine, if a child is raised with parents who are optimistic or pessimistic, does the child normally echo the parent?
Well, this is a very, very interesting question, George. We absolutely know that our surroundings do make a big difference to what happens. Just to talk about what's going on with when I'm talking about an optimistic mind, if you like, and a pessimistic mind, we know that these ways of thinking are reflected in actual changes in the brain. So we have patterns of connections within our brain that underlie these different kinds of ways of thinking. So the analogy I often use is, it's a bit like water carving a pathway through sand. If you imagine water trickling down onto a beach, if the water continues in that same direction, gradually a pathway will get deeper and deeper, and eventually you'll get a river, so you'll get a channel, you know, a deeper and deeper channel. Now, the more you shift down that direction, the more entrenched that channel becomes. So, of course, this is exactly what happens in learning. So if you're surrounded by people who, say, are highly pessimistic, you will gradually start to look at things in a more negative way, and that actually starts changing your brain. The structure of your brain will start changing. So these pathways become quite entrenched and difficult to change. So we know that, you know, obviously, if you have a lot of negative influences or a lot of positive influences, the respective brain systems will become more and more entrenched and more difficult to shift. The interesting thing, though, is, of course, the analogy I use is it's laid down in sand. So it's not impossible to shift. It, you know, it is possible to shift, but not necessarily easy. So on the one hand, we know that things that happen to us are absolutely crucial in terms of how we're brought up. But we also know that our genetic makeup makes a difference as well. But it's absolutely how the genes and our environment work together. That's really what's important. And there's numerous studies now that, that demonstrate that quite beautifully. I can just tell you very quickly about one really nice study that, that illustrates that point very, very nicely.
Okay.
Several years ago, a study was published now where the researchers were very interested in whether people with the short version of a particular gene, it's actually the same gene that I used and tested in Michael J. Fox, it's called the serotonin transporter gene. Now, there's good biological reasons to think that people who hold a shorter version of that gene are more likely to develop depression. So we know that biologically.
Interesting.
So basically, the researchers followed people for a very long period of time. They started off when all of the study participants were only 3 years of age. They were just toddlers. And they followed them for a 25-year period, so a very long period of time.
A 25-year study? That's amazing, isn't it?
It's a huge, it was a really long study, so a great study. And every single year of those 25 years, they got everybody back into the lab. They gave them a full medical. They did extensive interviews. They really found out, you know, what was going on in people's lives. Had major events happened? Had they lost a parent? Had they suffered child abuse? You know, had really good things happened? So they took very, very detailed records of what was going on every single year for all of that 25 years. And obviously they measured people's genotype on this particular gene. Did they have the short version or the longer version? At the end of the 25-year period, they looked at those people who had had a diagnosis of depression. So they were able to then say, you know, would the shorter version of the gene predict risk of depression? What they found, much to their surprise, when they looked at the data, was that actually the rate of depression wasn't any higher in those with the shorter version of the gene compared to those with the longer version of the gene. So you can imagine their feelings. After 25 years, they must have thought, well, you know, we really haven't found what we were expecting to find.
Right.
So initially, the data looked pretty as if the genes had nothing to do with it. However, when they then took into account the kind of things that had happened to people, the life events that had happened to people, and remember they had these very, very detailed records, then the picture changed dramatically. Then what they found was if people had had three or more really pretty negative things happen to them, and they also had the short version of this particular gene, then the risk of depression was much, much higher. However, if they had the longer version of the gene and lots of negative things had happened, the risk of depression didn't increase. George, that's a really interesting study because it
sure
tells
is.
Us two really important things. First of all, it tells us that the gene on its own wasn't enough to predict depression, but it also tells us that the life events on their own wasn't enough to predict depression. So in other words, it was a particular combination
of it.
Particular life events and a particular type of gene or variation of a gene that formed a kind of a toxic combination, if you like. So the story is a little bit more complicated, and hence, as I said, there's no such thing as an optimism gene or, you know, a pessimism gene or a depression gene. It's very much how our genetic makeup interleaves with the kind of things that happen in our lives that ultimately start shifting these particular brain states, which I call rainy brain and sunny brain states.
Elaine, do you find that a pessimistic person can be a successful person in life, in relationships, in business?
Yes, I think I can. I mean, obviously, the research does suggest that people with a more optimistic mindset are generally more successful. But as I said, we absolutely need both sides of our rainy brain and sunny brain. So one of the things I try to really argue is that it's really about getting those brain states in a kind of a balance. It's almost like what your grandmother would have said to you, in a sense. I mean, in the last chapter, I struggled a little bit, about trying not to sound too trivial about this, but it's absolutely true that if we keep things in balance and in moderation, that's actually the formula for well-being and for health. So we need a healthy dose of pessimism a lot of the time. You know, obviously, there are things that don't work out. You know, pessimism is there for a good reason. But the problem is, if pessimism becomes overarching, if you like, so people start seeing the negative in everything or start thinking nothing is ever going to work out, that's when it can become a problem. But a healthy dose of pessimism is perfectly normal and perfectly beneficial. So in many ways, you know, having a pessimist and an optimist together is often a real benefit. And again, one of the nice things somebody told me recently is they said that, you know, the aeroplane was invented by an optimist, but it was a pessimist who invented the parachute. So that's kind of a nice analogy. So I think in life, we obviously need both. We need a bit of pessimism. But overall, there's no doubt that if that gets out of control, that's the problem. If people start thinking, you know, nothing is ever going to work out. So and also just going back to the idea that it's not just about positive thinking or negative thinking. It's also about this sense of control and the idea of persistence. Sure. If somebody starts tipping into, say, depression, they tend to get the sense that they don't have much control. They'll tend to, you know, not get out in the morning, not try out things. And that's when, you know, extreme pessimism can really start interfering with people's lifestyles. I think that's when, you know, there's good reasons why people should probably try to change. But a lot of the time, pessimism is quite a healthy thing.
Well, sometimes being a pessimist is confused with being someone who's realistic, isn't it?
That's right. And I think that's right. And I think it's actually incorrect. I mean, there are some great studies in psychology that initially confirmed that, or seemed to confirm that. So, for example, I'll just tell you one study where the researchers, you flash up a sequence of lights. So lights come on one after the other on a computer screen, and people simply have to press buttons in relation to those lights. And the simple question is, do you think that you pressing the buttons has any influence whatsoever on whether or not the lights flash on or off? Now, of course, the study is set up so that it's totally random. So the lights are actually flashing on randomly. You're pressing buttons randomly. There's no relationship. When you ask pessimists and optimists about that, what you find is that the pessimists tend to be extremely accurate. They say, no, I don't have any control. It's pretty random, which is the truth. Optimists tend to have a sense that they have some degree of control. So they have a kind of an illusion of control, if you like, which is really fascinating. They have the sense that, you know, maybe they have a little bit of control over it. Now, that's very interesting. And a lot of the, for many years, psychologists thought that this was kind of pretty strong proof that actually pessimists are more realistic. However, a very clever psychologist came along then and did exactly the same kind of study, but this time the simple task was changed. You simply had to observe another person doing the task. And again, the same question was put. You know, does the person have any influence over the lights going on or off? Now the pessimists were actually inaccurate. They were less accurate than the optimists. So the optimists now said, no, actually it looks to me like I don't have much. It looks pretty random. Whereas the pessimists said they have a lot more control. So in other words, the pessimists, when they were looking at other people, felt that other people had more control. But when they're looking at themselves, they were actually, in this case, more accurate. So I think that's a nice, simple experiment that kind of shows us the benefits, in a sense, of having this illusion of control. You know, even when it is an illusion, it kind of encourages us to go and try and do things, which I think is probably why optimism on balance is very beneficial in terms of our health, in terms of our success in business. So I think, you know, it's very important that we have that kind of sense of control, if you like.
Can you teach someone to be truly optimistic?
Well, again, that's a great question, and obviously it's a very, very difficult one. Again, going back to the analogy I was saying about, you know, these pathways going through the sand, so that we have these, it's a little bit like that in the brain. We have these streams of chemicals that we know underlie optimism and pessimism. So the more entrenched they are, the more difficult they're going to be to change. But of course, there's a lot of research going on in neuroscience and psychology to really try and see, can we change these mindsets? And in the last 10 years or so, there's been some really startling findings showing that it is possible to change. The bad news, I suppose, is that it's not particularly easy. There's no kind of magic bullet. There's no really easy method. But there are techniques that are absolutely effective if people stick with them. Now, again, it very much depends where people are along the spectrum, if you like. If people are really, say, right on the edge of, say, depression or anxiety, so serious disorders like that, then there are techniques that they would probably need to go to a professional to help with. So things like cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the famous talking therapy, I mean, that's been shown that it can actually shift these different brain states. If people really stick with that, in cognitive behavioral therapy, you get a lot of little tasks like challenging your negative beliefs, for example, because usually when you boil these kind of beliefs down, it turns out a lot of them are pretty irrational. You know, so a depressed person might say, you know, that nothing ever works out well for me. Nothing ever goes well. In the entire day, nothing works out. Actually, it's generally very easy. If you really start looking at what they've done in that day, it's generally a couple of things you'll find actually did work out. So challenging your negative beliefs in those ways can be very, very powerful. There's also mindfulness-based meditation. There's a lot of research now showing that mindfulness-based meditation is a really effective method if people stick with it. And most of these kind of interventions go on for about 8 weeks or 10 weeks as a minimum. But in terms of everyday life, you know, say just people who aren't particularly clinically depressed or clinically anxious, but may just feel that they're a bit overly pessimistic and would like to change. I do, in the book, I do talk about a number of tips to try and change. I think, first of all, I suppose the most general issue is getting more exercise, having a balanced diet. That's absolutely crucial. It's not rocket science, as we often say, but what is surprising is how few people actually take that on board. So the very first start is really just trying to get out and about a bit more, trying to get a bit more exercise, trying to eat a reasonably healthy diet. So once you do that, that's the kind of the core thing. The more psychological things then, there's a range of things. One is the absolute crucial thing is shifting perspectives. So again, going back to the idea of these cognitive biases we were talking about, you know, if all of us reacted to things in exactly the same way, we'd all be pretty much similar. So we obviously know that there isn't a direct relationship between the things that happen in the world and how we feel about it. You know, that's
and it's also good, though, to vary it, isn't it, between being a pessimist and an optimist? Even though I think you should be optimistic most of the time, I don't think you should be optimistic all of the time, Eli.
No, absolutely. And again, that's again exactly why, you know, we have our rainy brain and our sunny brain. And you know, I'm really kind of arguing that we absolutely need both of those. Because as I was saying, you know, you do need a healthy dose of pessimism. So it's really, you know, I mean, often people say to me, like, should we try and change? Should we be more optimistic? And my answer is always, well, it depends if it's really interfering with your life. You know, if, as you say, a healthy dose of pessimism is absolutely fine, it's absolutely normal, and it's a very healthy thing. But if it becomes a bit overarching and becomes a bit over general, so that people really begin to feel that nothing is going well for them and it's interfering with them and their friends and their relationships, that's when, you know, I think there's good reasons to try and change.
Where do we get your book, Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain?
Well, it's out in all the shops now, and also I have a website. So the website is www.rainybrainsunnybrain.com. So pretty easy to remember, just the title of the book, rainybrainsunnybrain.com, all one word. So people can find out all of the information there.
Okay, and when we come back, Elaine, at the top of the hour, I'm going to open up the phone lines. We'll have an hour of phone calls with you. People who are optimistic or pessimistic, check in with us. We're with psychologist Elaine Fox talking about how to retrain your brain to become pessimistic, to overcome being a pessimist and achieve a more positive outlook. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.